Welcome to the Idea Pod, a podcast dedicated to exploring and interrogating applied ethics at the University of Leeds.
Hello, and welcome to the Sex Pod, a podcast series exploring the medical, ethical, and philosophical issues surrounding sex work, with a special focus on sex work during the COVID-19 pandemic. This Sex Pod podcast is being produced in collaboration with Idea Pod podcast. Today I'm joined by Dr. Anna Weston, philosopher, artist, and musician. Dr. Weston is currently interested in sex trafficking research and activism, but she has also written on the ethics of prostitution and published a well-received paper in the Journal of Medical Ethics critiquing Dr. Martin Moen's article, Is Prostitution Harmful? So I'd like to say a big welcome to Dr. Weston.
It's such a treat to be on this podcast.
Today I'm hoping to get Dr. Weston's perspective on the ethical issues surrounding sex work. But before we get into that, could I just ask you, Dr. Weston, to give our listeners a brief overview of your research interests?
So my name's Anna, and I did my PhD on existential phenomenology of addiction, but I've also done some work with prostitution ethics. I did an MA in bioethics. And that work has kind of furthered through my work with survivors of human trafficking in the UK. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of turned into more a philosophy of trauma and a philosophy of addiction and a kind of existential experiences of trauma and addiction. But prostitution as an existential situation was really what I first became interested in.
And you're a lecturer as well, is that right?
Yeah, I lecture at St. Mary's University as a visiting lecturer, LST, and I'm a visiting fellow at St. Mary's and at Kent, the University of Kent.
Okay, thank you. I'm just interested to hear a bit more about the work you do with trafficking in the UK.
Well, we were doing a lot of theoretical work on ethical situations, human rights. I'd done some work on human rights philosophy, and I felt like the missing piece was the practical, the existential experience in kind of real life. And I got involved with a kind of a collective of artists and musicians, and we started fundraising for survivors of trafficking in abroad, and then started realizing that there were survivors of trafficking in the UK. And then I basically did some trauma training, and we started, instead of raising money for survivors elsewhere, we started actually having retreats and working with survivors as artists in their own right and as, you know, musicians in their own right, and mm-hmm. looking at how to move the story on from their trauma and into their future.
That sounds really interesting. And do you feel that your sort of basis in philosophy and the theoretical side of things has helped with that?
I definitely do. Yeah. I think especially the existential and the phenomenology, where you're situated in the whole picture of a life.
Yeah.
So you've got those ethical, you know, you've got the ethical situations, but the ethical's connected to, you know, what your body and what is it to be a body and, you know.
Yeah, and that's something that you sort of mentioned quite a lot in the writing that I've read that you've done about sex work, isn't it? Sort of what is it to be human and all the rest of those sort of issues that come up with that. And I think one of the things I was going to ask you just before we get into all of that is, would you just mind saying a little bit about the definition of sex work that you take in your research, and like what is sex work to you when you're writing and thinking about it?
Yeah, it's so interesting. It's, you know, the exchange of sexual activity for money is the broad definition that I would use. I think it's problematic. So I think sexual activity is such a wide definition. I think there are particular dimensions of sexual activity that I would be more interested in than others, but that's what I would generally say.
Yeah, and a lot of the sort of writing and research around it sort of focuses on this sort of exchange of sex for money when the person selling sex is female and the clients are male. Would you say that that's a scenario that your work applies to, or do you think it could be broader than that?
Yeah, I mean, I want to, in terms of vulnerability, I think it's independent of gender or sexual orientation. I think most of my work has been with female identifying persons. So that's kind of my context for my work.
Yeah. And just in terms of the sort of stance you take with the ethics and the philosophy and the morals of selling sex, do you think you would be able to sum up the sort of stance that you sort of take ethically or philosophically?
Yeah, I think prostitution can incur existential harms in ways that differ to other occupations.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think it is about prostitution that makes the existential harms different to mm-hmm. other occupations?
So I think, I mean, kind of situating this, Andrew Wallace, who is the CEO of Unseen, did a really good interview mm-hmm. on criminalization of sex work and the problematic discourse. Mm-hmm. And I think I find it a problematic discourse because I think it's very easy to take an ethical position and just entrench yourself in it.
Unseen is a charity which works with the aim of abolishing trafficking and slavery while also supporting and safeguarding victims of human trafficking. In the interview Dr. Weston refers to, Andrew Wallace, the CEO of Unseen, states that Unseen cannot support the introduction of Nordic model type legislation if it is put under the banner of tackling trafficking because there is no evidence for it. In fact, the evidence is to the contrary. It makes the situation worse. As a reminder, under the Nordic model, clients purchasing sexual services from sex workers are criminalised. Wallace also emphasises that no single piece of legislation can be viewed as a silver bullet solution to the problems arising from sex trafficking. He emphasises the importance of asking, why is there a demand for trafficking for sexual exploitation, and how can we address this fundamental demand?
Yeah. And I want to be able to see a really nuanced view of harm, a really nuanced view of the reasons for people entering sex work and the actual experiences of people in sex work being very different. There's an incredible variety. I think what I'm concerned in terms of existential harm is that I pertain to issues of violence in the workplace and the conditions for entering, I think. The conditions for entering, the conditions for exit, and the context that can be a particularly violent one for many women, not for everyone.
I was curious to get Dr. Weston's view on whether the harm she associated with sex work originated from the actual act of selling sex, or whether she thought they arose from external conditions. I put this question to her.
So interesting. I think, I mean, many of the factors can be external. I think there can be internal factors. I mean, in terms of attachment theory, I think there can be particular psychological vulnerabilities.
Okay.
And it's not that it doesn't exist in other occupations, etc. I think there can be particular internal conditions that also can be harmful.
Yeah, so I suppose what you're saying is it's a bit of a combination of internal and external conditions.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was really interested by in your article is you sort of said that sex work is ethically challenging. I think you said because it involves these two moral agents acting under a contractual agreement. And I was just maybe going to ask you to say a bit more about that, because I was wondering, how is sex work in the way that the two agents act under a contractual agreement differing from other scenarios where two agents act under a contractual agreement?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that the terms of the contract can be different. The particular tools and conditions for work can be different. So yeah, just the concern for, so for instance, STDs, mm-hmm. That wouldn't be a concern in other occupations. So they're particular parts. And I think that that's assuming that there is a contractual agreement between autonomous individuals.
And I think that point that you just raised about autonomous individuals is quite interesting, because one of the other philosophers that I've spoken to has spoken a lot about how the conditions of sex work means that sex workers often don't have sexual autonomy.
I discussed this in much greater detail with Professor Scott A. Anderson in episode 3 of the podcast.
And I think that's something that's, it's definitely an issue, because I think that, like you said, there is a wide variety of sex workers. Mm-hmm. Some may have more or less autonomy depending on those internal and external factors. Something that you mentioned was about these agents in their contract being able to make rational decisions. And I was just wondering if you think that sort of ability to make rational decisions plays into the ability to make autonomous decisions. Are they connected mm-hmm. in any way, or are they sort of two separate entities? Mm-hmm.
I think rationality is a part of the condition of autonomy, mm-hmm. but it's not the only part. I think rationality is, I mean, philosophy and phenomenology, I guess, tells us rationality is such a nuanced thing. Mm-hmm. We think we're rational, and then we have all these, we have all these things underneath our supposed reason, but we have to use that language. So there has to be some kind of rationality. There has to be some ability to make a decision that constitutes autonomy.
Yeah, so I guess it's sort of maybe necessary to be rational, but just because you're making a rational decision doesn't necessarily mean it's an autonomous one.
Yeah.
And something I've just thought of what you said earlier is, like, you mentioned STDs and things as a sort of harm of sex work. I'm just wondering, really, that I suppose other jobs might have other different types of harms involved in them.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what you think, or what you think might make the specific harms of sex work different to the harms of other types of work. I'm just thinking a hazard of being a healthcare worker in the current climate is that you might catch COVID. I'm just wondering how that differs.
I mean, that's so interesting. The fact that there are so many professions where you are, I mean, journalists right now are putting, you know, putting their life in the line. So it is, that's a problematic thing. I think I am concerned at how many, the vulnerability for entering and staying in sex work. And I think there was a Swiss study that kind of came in with 37% of sex workers like their jobs, and you know, 23% said they couldn't find another job. Da, 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 da. And again, those statistics, you look at nursing, could be quite similar. But yeah. I think I'm concerned that the factors of coercion are so much higher in sex work. I'm concerned with the statistics of human trafficking related to sex work in the UK.
Because obviously you do doing a lot of work with people who have been victims of trafficking, and I was just wondering if many of those people you see have been involved in sex work, and what sort of relation and stuff would be in your...
Most of the women that we've worked with have been involved in sex work, mm-hmm. and were trafficked for sex work. I think coming from that and seeing the coercion, seeing the violence, seeing the kind of physical damage to these women's bodies, that's going to continue for the rest of their lives is quite sobering. And that is, you know, the statistics are like 2018 sexual exploitation statistics for human trafficking were 1,926 people were registered in the National Referral Mechanism, but that's out of 72,000 sex workers in the UK. So that's quite a small number, but it's a significant number, mm-hmm. I think. And so I think I would say I'm more concerned for individuals whose particular life situations make them vulnerable to conditions for work that are particularly violent. And
I suppose that might not, that can include sex work, but might not be exclusively sex work.
Yeah. Yeah. And so these statistics are for sex work, but yeah, because I mean, they've got labor exploitation, which is high as well.
And then you sort of emphasize that the ethics governing sex work and sexual ethics is distinguishable from other types of ethics. And
yeah.
I was just wondering, if is this the reason that you think that sex work is sort of unique in this ethical context? Or is it something about actual physical act of selling sex?
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so in the article, I said that there are so many different forms of sexual ethics.
Yeah.
And I think what I was challenging Moen in his very interesting article was a narrowly defined sexual ethic that said, you know, either there's harm or there's no harm. And I think it depends on your definition of ethical harm.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at virtue ethics, you can say, is it a particular form of relationship that you want to espouse? Or for me, I think that there are many different kinds of sexual ethic.
Okay, and would you say that some of those different kinds apply to some people and some apply to others? How do they sort of all interplay?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're looking from an existential position, it's how does it play into the pursuit of this person's good life, right?
Right.
And ethics can also say, and we have a definition of what that good life is, you know, like the Greek definition was a particular form of a good life, you know, the Western, I don't know, there's a certain form of a good life. So how does sex work fit into that definition of a good life? And that definition of a good life will be the ethical context for an individual. And
yeah. Do you think that to sort of think about how sex work fits into a good life, we need to think about how sex unrelated to work fits into a good life, and what that
is? Yeah, I think we do. I think we do. And I think that is such an individual, you know, deliberation and weighing. But I think it would be good to examine sex anew.
Yeah.
And to allow space to look into how do we value it? How does it sit in terms of our life story? How am I valuing my relationships to other people and using sex in them?
I found the suggestion that the value of sex and its role in somebody's good life should be treated as highly individual really compelling. The choice one person makes around sex might enhance their own good life, but the same choices could be completely incompatible with another person's view of a good life. It seems as though it is possible, at least theoretically, for sex work to be compatible with a good life for some, but not necessarily all individuals. I wonder if the question we need to be asking is, how do we create legislation and public policy to protect the rights of all these people, despite them holding different values and experiencing different life circumstances?
Yeah, that's very interesting. And is it possible?
Yeah.
I think in a really pragmatic way, does the Nordic model present a way in which we can do that, and we can value the autonomy of the sex worker and you know, look at the client who's buying, or maybe that, you know, are there different ways of doing it? I don't know that we'll ever find a perfect system.
No, and I'd be really interested actually to hear your thoughts on the Nordic model, because it's quite a controversial isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say I grew up in Sweden, and there's something about accountability for buying that I think is good, in terms of a client taking accountability for their choice in a way that somehow puts less pressure on the sex worker whose situation can be more complicated. That I can see the benefit of. I don't know that it does much for human trafficking. I don't know how much it really does protect vulnerable individuals. But there are some theoretical things I like about it.
I think when I was like doing all my initial research and reading about things, I sort of heard the Nordic model, and my initial reaction was kind of like, oh, well, yeah, that like kind of like what you just said, that seems to maybe make sense, hold the people who are buying the service accountable. But sort of what I've come to realize a bit is speaking to B from the EC and some of the other people who work with sex workers is that in reality, that model ends up actually increasing the vulnerability of the sex worker, because it puts more power into the hands of the client, because they are the ones who are taking the risk. Mm. So they're more likely to demand their services, be more violent. And sort of if less people are willing to take the risk of visiting a sex worker, there's a decreased demand for sex work, but there's still all these sex workers who have to make money. And interestingly, it's been sort of suggested that the COVID restrictions in the UK, you know, when it was lockdown and social distancing and all the rest of it, have meant that it's kind of been like a practice run in the UK for what it would be like if there was a Nordic model. Because obviously buying sex in sort of the necessity of being in close contact with people was criminalized. And I think it sounds like the sex workers had a really tough time during COVID. I think your distinction between what sounds like good theoretically and what actually works can be quite distant sometimes.
Yeah. And I think that's true. And I think that's why I find prostitution ethics so tricky, is it's like, I mean, this is love, like we can talk about these ethical situations when you see the messy reality of life.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, and this is what legislation always has to deal with, but it's trickier. And like you're saying, like things go underground. You know, you shift from brothel to the internet. You like there's all these different ways of then changing to adapt to the form that the legislation might take.
And I was just going to ask you, actually, I was interested by what you said earlier about how some of the people you work with who are victims of trafficking have sort of had irreparable harms and that they're suffering from their body and things. I don't know if that will be extended to their sense of self. And you focus quite a lot on the sort of type of harm. And I was just wondering if you could maybe say a bit more about that.
Yeah, I think it's, if you have been raped or you have been gang raped, then it can cause damage to your sexual organs. And some of that it can be treated and some of that can be permanent. And I think just psychologically working with women who came to the UK under much different conditions than they ended up being here. But there's such manipulation, just psychological manipulation.
I am just interrupting to highlight that this discussion is not conflating sex work and human trafficking, but exploring how the two can sometimes become interlinked.
With that, with the trafficking and sex work, I suppose it's quite hard. I mean, obviously there's some physical harms which are sort of undeniable, but that it's quite hard to sort of separate the harms from coercion and manipulation and the harms that are physical to your body that may, I'm just wondering if it can be separated or if it's sort of intrinsically linked and that's what makes it harmful.
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, in that article, which I wrote quite a few years ago, I think I just wanted to say harm was nuanced.
Yeah.
Harm was nuanced. And it's, you know, how it could be that the individual has totally chosen this as a profession, and they're proud of it, and they do it, and they do it safely, and there are others who in which it can be very harmful, and it can harm other relationships, and it can harm. So I think I just really want a nuance.
Yeah, I think that is really important, because, like, I guess, like anything, it is, all of this is so individual, isn't it? And what's right for one person might not be right for the other. You sort of said that when we're thinking about harm associated with sex work, we kind of need to think about what it is to be human, and whether sex work makes somebody less of a human and more of an object. And I think I was just quite interested in that idea that of objectification, and whether that is intrinsically harmful, or if it's the surrounding conditions that is harmful.
Yeah. I wonder whether they will always be tied.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that the objectification and the external conditions are always somehow enmeshed. I think, I mean, if you kind of go from an ethical perspective and you look at organ donation for profit, there's sex would be different because you're not taking something permanently, so it's more of a renting of space. I think, I don't know, but the existential situation of sex is, I would argue, a different situation to other transactional situations, due to the nature of intimacy, due to the nature of attachment and relationship. And that's kind of taking more of an attachment theory perspective. And I know a lot of people would problematize that, but I think it's just worth holding in tension. I think it maybe is problematic when I say it, but the kind of the relational, putting a relational transaction, a relational exchange, and putting monetary transaction on that relational exchange feels existentially problematic to me. Okay. Even though that is a very nuanced thing.
That's really interesting, actually, because B, who, like I said before, was the member of the English Collective of Prostitutes, said that, I think, sort of echoed what you just said, really, which is that people feel uncomfortable with the idea of selling sex because sex workers are charging for those things that other people give away for free, were like sex, intimacy, attachment. And I thought that was quite an interesting point, because it is a feeling, isn't it, that you might get, and I guess you have to decide, well, is that feeling sort of based in the idea that, oh, there is something really important and special about this, or is it our sort of own biases, I guess?
Yeah, and I think that's super interesting and really important. I think, like, would I put a transaction on friendship? You know, would I put if this is just another relational exchange?
Yeah, would it be that genuine?
Yeah, and I think I just kind of want to hold that. And then I also probably want to problematize it a bit and say, well, you know, if you're a care worker taking care of someone, they're being paid to spend time with that person. But are they, you know, a friend of that person? What does it mean to have intimate relationships? And I think that's where sexual ethics becomes an interesting thing.
I guess it could be argued that, like sex workers who are selling a sexual service aren't saying, oh, I'm selling all my affection and this relationship, I'm selling a service like any other service.
Exactly. Yeah,
but it's just, can they be separated in those two ways? And I think my probably gut reaction would be, maybe for some people they can, maybe for some people they can't.
I think that's why the nuance is so important in the conversation, is like, okay, so do we need to have a definitive position? And And why is that problematic? I think that's why it's kind of coming back to that, what is it to cause harm, and for that individual. And I know that's a very tricky way to do like legislative decisions. But I think as a philosopher, I just want to keep that interrogation.
Yeah, not let that sort of fall by the wayside. Something I just thought of when we were chatting then is that, like you mentioned about like renting the body rather than selling compared to organ donation. And I was wondering how types of sex work that are not a physical service necessarily, so like selling services over webcam or phone or people in the porn industry or something, I wonder if the harms that they might experience are different to people who are seeing clients in person.
I think there does need to be a nuance on harm. So I mean just kind of physically, if you're having vaginal intercourse, you're gonna have different physical harms than if you're a porn actor, or you know, like, or if you're, you know, pole dancing, that's a very different experience of harm than or just experience than, you know, street work. So it's it is so nuanced, and it almost feels they're somewhat incomparable, those situations.
And I guess those nuances and different individual differences and things, like you said, just making a legislative decision and things so difficult. I guess from my position and things that I've sort of read and researched, it seems to me like the steps should be taken to make it as least harmful as it possibly can be. And I guess it's just getting to the point where how can that be done? And I think that's just such a big question, isn't it?
It's such a big question. And I think it's an immigration question. And I think it's, I think it's a multi-dimensional question. It's, you know, what other work is available? You know, it's a real whole society question.
Yeah. And then something else I was going to ask you is, if we think about examining sort of what it means to be human and how that is linked to sex work, when I've been thinking about sort of sex work in the pandemic, sex workers have been vulnerable to economic hardship like everyone else. I guess that they've maybe faced really difficult decisions about, oh, do I go and sell sex? Or like I faced that choice of not being able to put food on the table. I guess going to working and economic hardship is not something that's specific to sex work. So I'm just wondering if those like sort of dire economic circumstances and homelessness and economic instability, I wonder if they could affect what it means to be human in the same way as selling sex. So some people might see selling sex as the best option. It maybe takes away less of that humanity than being homeless and not being able to support themselves might.
Definitely. Yeah. I think if one is in a situation where one can't make money to feed yourself, then you're going to go for the best option. That's a very human response.
Yeah. We spoke briefly about the Nordic model, but there seems to be a consensus among sex workers and those who work with sex workers that decriminalizing sex work could go some way to sort of reducing some of the harms that sex workers face. But I know there's often that's met with quite a lot of resistance. I think often out of concern, but I was just wondering what your opinion would be on that and how that might affect thinking about some sort of women that you work with and things.
I think I'm still on the fence about it, if I'm being honest. I can see the benefits of a decriminalizing. I can see problems with it in terms of this nuanced view of harm. I think a wider discourse on coercion and violence and exploitation are needed.
Okay.
Yeah, I think decriminalizing brings important factors into the conversation, which is that the well-being of these people is of primary concern. And I think that that is always the most important thing. I think I'm still mulling over the harms of prostitution. To jump fully.
So when you were sort of saying you think there's problems with the decriminalisation around sort of the harms, what sort of harms do you think it could exacerbate or make worse?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's just good to keep that tension of looking at what is relationship and what is transactional relationship. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know that's a wider question about lots of different things, but I do want to keep that question. Yeah,
I guess the hard thing about that is you've got the sort of theoretical, philosophical questions, which are really important like that. And then you've got real people in real time who are sort of experiencing hardship and harms, and it's like you really want to be able to think about those, but are we thinking about them at the expense of experience, I suppose.
And I guess I'm concerned with would that actually affect the situations of people who've been sexually trafficked? So for me, sex work, I think, is a nuanced, the different kinds of sex work, it's so nuanced. Mm-hmm. So I don't pretend to be an expert on, mm-hmm. on sex work. I think my particular little niche of human trafficking, I think I'm just concerned. I'm not convinced that it will benefit victims of sex trafficking.
Yeah.
But it could, you know, if it's more monitored, if there are, you know, greater access to healthcare in particular, I think that's really important. Mm. Then it could become more of a safe space for people.
What is how have you found like the pandemic and COVID and things has affected your work with people who have been sexually trafficked, and also the rates of sex trafficking, and have they been affected at all?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Well, so I've actually had to be in Canada for most of this time, so we've had to kind of lay low with our work, but they don't have the statistics out yet, but from colleagues there's a suggestion that it's increased, but it's just gone kind of further underground. And the tricky thing is that people are just not able to access these people, and a sense of even knowing who, you know, how to access people in the way that you could pre-COVID.
It's just so hard to know, isn't it, in the time of COVID, what's been going on.
Yeah, just in terms of our practical work, it's just been hard because we couldn't meet up for so long. So kind of saying, oh, let's have a safe place. It's like, oh, maybe in 2 months, maybe in 3 months. And then people who are survivors of sex work, so that's what we're working with mostly, is survivors of sex work, are just, you know, you're just stuck in accommodation, and then you're more vulnerable.
And what do you think the people you work with who say like are survivors of trafficking and things, what do you think their sort of opinions on sex work as work and the harms of it would be? I suppose it'll be different for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for everyone. I know just the individuals that I've been working with, there's just a sense of wanting to do other things.
Mm.
Because it wasn't something that they chose.
Yeah.
You know, so it's quite a different thing from someone who's chosen it. And that's why I don't want to speak for all, you know, but it's something that they haven't chosen, and just kind of working through trauma.
Thank you so much. You've given me so many great insights. It's been really, really great to have you on.
Oh, well, it's a privilege for me.
Thank you for listening. That was Dr. Anna Weston on the ethics of sex work and the harms of human trafficking. See you next time.
The Idea Pod is produced by the Interdisciplinary Ethics Applied Centre at the University of Leeds. Find out more at ahc.leeds.ac.uk/ethics. Music composed and conducted by Josh Armitage.